I got something for the show today.
Oh, wow.
Well, that's good. You showing up with the content. Holy crap.
No, but this is something I'm like genuinely excited about. And like it was nothing.
Oh, so all our other topics you've not been excited about? Is that what you're saying, Noah?
So a couple of weeks ago, I saw this post from a friend that we were friends back in high school. And basically what it said was, is he said he was really disappointed in all of the posts that he sees of political memes, because it's basically just you can make anything sound stupid if you take a sentence out of context, put a couple of words in a goofy picture, and you make anything sound stupid. And so what he said was he would encourage people that this election season, they should research things a little bit more and learn a little bit more about them rather than just basing everything off of a meme. And I thought, man, it's 15 days before the, at the time it was like 20 days before the election. And if I were to sit and I would just say, what are the 10 most important things or the 15 most important things that I think are important for this election or the concepts that you should understand if you're going to go in and vote, what would those concepts be? If somebody didn't understand politics, what would they need to know? And so I started this essentially series, and I said, this is, I'm going to lay out the like 15 concepts that you should understand when you go to vote for a candidacy. And I posted the intro, and I said, this is what I'm going to do, and I don't want swearing, and I don't want name-calling, and I don't want, you know, people dragging things off topic saying huff at it.
Why are you making political posts?
Well, because Facebook. Because I think that there is a way that mature adults can have a discussion about the political season, and I think that it's important that people do, and I think it's important people get out and vote. And if people are scared from voting because it's just, well, we can't trust anyone, and my vote doesn't count anyway, and you get that kind of mentality, then that kind of disrupts the whole country. So I make the intro post and a bunch of people like it. And so then I was like, so more people are interested in this than I originally thought. So I sit down with Sarah and I said, help me organize this because I ramble a little bit. Help me, you know, boil it down. And she's like, well, you need 3 points and you need an intro that people will read. And then you need, you know, basically a summary at the end. So she helps me construct the first one. And I put it up today, 10 o'clock in the morning or something like that. And I look back and there's like 70 some notifications in my Facebook feed. And I click on it. And like one guy is like, I don't even know you. I'm a mutual friend of a mutual friend. And so I just added you so I could see these posts. And I'm like, well, I didn't expect that to happen.
Deep below the surface, Amazon is developing a lot of cool technologies. And a lot of time when we talk about cloud hosting or a cloud provider, we talk about Google and we talk about Dropbox and we talk about Apple and things like that. But, you know, with Amazon, if you're already a Prime member, there's a lot of stuff they're including these days. And I wonder if maybe they might not be a better choice for somebody to host my MP3s and host my pictures that I do want to have available online. I always am going to have local copies of stuff, but sometimes it's nice, like I'll give you an example with the Amazon MP3 player.
Mm-hmm.
On any computer I edit at, I have a large music library that I can download any clips because I've chosen to upload all of those to the Amazon MP3 library.
Mm-hmm.
And it just makes it really nice when editing that I have my library of clips up on a service that I can pull down on any tiny laptops. And also Prime members have now just gotten this new family vault feature that gives families a way to share Prime photos and free storage.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a Prime member, you already get unlimited photo storage via Prime photos. But today, Amazon extended that benefit to the family members of a main account holder with the launch of the new Prime Photos feature called Family Vault. And with Family Vault, an Amazon Prime member can invite up to 5 family members or friends to join their online account in order to combine photos and take advantage of free photo storage, as well as another 5 gigs for videos and other files. So Amazon's got a lot of different services now in their ecosystem, mm-hmm. that with a pretty good back-end infrastructure and generally ways to make it work under Linux as well as the other platforms.
Yeah.
And yet they're never really part of the conversation.
I have noticed that as well. I think it first hit me when they did Amazon Prime Video. I didn't pay anything extra for Prime Video. I certainly didn't sign up for my Prime account because I cared about Amazon Prime Video. That was back at the time when Netflix didn't work under Linux, even with the hackaround thing that you had to do before even that. And I was at a hotel and I just opened Chrome up and went to Amazon Prime Video. And I just started watching a TV show and I was like,
yeah. That was my impression too. Like, wait a minute, this is just working?
Yeah, why is nobody talking about this? Like, there's a video service that works under Linux and nobody's talking about it.
I can tell you specifically that the reason that they're not talking about it is because it only partially works. If you want HD content on Amazon, you need to use the same hacks that you used to have to use for Netflix because they use the same Wildvine DRM stuff.
Oh, okay. Okay. See, I haven't poked at it enough because I really, when I think of, which I don't do often, if I ever think of video online, I think of YouTube, Google Play. I don't think often of Amazon, even though I know they have
it. Yeah. It's weird that Amazon uses two different ways of sending out their stuff because all their SD content works, but their HD content uses specialized DRM.
You know, to be honest with you, when I use Amazon Video, essentially what I'm using it for is I'm in a hotel and I just want something on in the background to kill the silence. I guess I really don't care. And usually it's like a max 2 or 3 meg down connection anyway. I guess I don't really care if it's HD or SD. I'm just kind of happy that I have it. And again, it's something that I consider, you know, icing on the cake. It's not what I'm paying for Prime anyway.
Rika, though, what do you think about when you look at the Amazon ecosystem and the Amazon cloud that you can be using, and you also consider that they've just recently launched Twitch Prime at the end of September? And Twitch Prime is it's a new service that, because remember, Amazon bought Twitch back in 2014, right? I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
Amazon bought Twitch. So they've been sort of doing a few things behind the scenes, some big things and little things. But I think Twitch Prime is kind of like the biggest thing they've launched since Amazon bought them. They call it their premium experience on Twitch that's included with Amazon Prime. As a Twitch Prime member, you get free game loot every month, like instant access to the newest Hearthstone hero, and there's other things. You also receive discounts on new release box games sold by Amazon during the pre-order period. And on Twitch, once you link your Amazon Prime account to your Twitch account, you get ad-free viewing on Twitch and exclusive emotes and chat badges.
Yeah, Twitch used to have this thing called Twitch Turbo, which was a similar thing. It let you have the ad-free experience. It didn't give you the extra loot, but from what I've been telling, most people don't care about the extra loot anyway. And I like it because now I just have one less thing I have to pay for, because I used to pay for Prime and Twitch Turbo separately, and now I just get it with Prime.
So they even put it in bold text at the end of the blog. If you already have Amazon Prime, you already get Twitch Prime, you just have to link your account. For some reason, they really want those accounts linked up. Probably something they're going to roll out down the road, I would imagine.
I don't even think it's that. I think they'll get better analytics on what gamers want, and they'll offer better products.
Yeah, interesting. So the Amazon's making some big moves, but yet not a big part of, I feel like what it might suffer from is the Silicon Valley bubble that a lot of the tech reporting comes out of, and Amazon's a Seattle company.
I don't think that's it. I think that the problem is that most people these days use all these services through their phones, and Amazon's apps suck balls.
Hmm.
There's like no integration that feels native on the phone side, and Google Play has good integration. All the Apple stuff has good integration, but the Amazon apps just are terrible.
Which could you elaborate on that? So all Amazon apps?
Except for maybe the Amazon shopping app, which is okay.
Yeah, the Amazon.com like app to buy stuff is okay. But you're right.
Sorry, go ahead.
Amazon Music, for example, for me on Android, mm-hmm. always runs in the background and then randomly crashes. And I'm sitting there using another app and I get an error message saying Amazon Music has stopped working or something.
And it doesn't feel like it fits in with the rest of the OS. It eats a lot of battery.
I've had mixed results with it. I don't have any good things to really say about their video app either. I think it's kind of a clunky app. I mean, it does the job. I think all of their apps are kind of a little clunky.
I think even the actual Amazon.com web interface kind of sucks. Like, it's really hard to search for things.
Yeah. I mean, you could literally, their search itself is pretty good, but like navigating the site to find things is kind of a dumpster fire. So they're kind of a hot mess in some ways. But what I like about Amazon is from my desktop, they're a pretty good back end to integrate in with the photos and the music and the storage.
Is that using apps that they have made or third-party apps?
Using their web interface usually and things like that. I don't know. I find it to be – they have pretty compelling offerings, but I just don't think it's part of the discussion. I don't know. I just kind of want – that was the more notable thing, and me sort of in the back of my mind going – could this actually rival Google Photos? This would be kind of nice. I'm super creeped out by giving Google my photos, but the ability to index and search is very valuable to me, because what's the point of having all this footage and all of these pictures if I can't accurately retrieve them later on when I actually want them?
Let me ask you something. Are you familiar with the Amazon Prime backup features? Not necessarily for photos, but where you can back like anything up and supposedly it's unlimited?
You know, I'm just remotely familiar with it. I've never tried it.
So the first time I heard that, I didn't even believe it. Somebody goes, oh, there's unlimited backup. And I said, uh-huh, sure there is. And then I heard it from one or two more people, and then I kind of looked into it. The best I can tell, the only downside to it is they limit the speed at which you can transfer data. So if you have a ton of data, it's going to be very difficult to get it all up on Amazon if you ever have
to restore. Yeah, they have two things, right? I mean, you get unlimited storage for photos if with Prime, and then they have unlimited storage you can upgrade to for $60 a year for photos, videos, music, documents, and more.
Yeah. So what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, it seems to make a lot of sense. I mean, they obviously have the storage and compute infrastructure with Amazon S3 and the AWS infrastructure. So it seems like they are uniquely positioned to be able to offer something like this at a very competitive cost. And it also obviously integrates in with their Prime services in a pretty straightforward way. I think only Google is one of the other few companies this is uniquely positioned. Oh, and maybe Microsoft. Maybe Microsoft
with
Azure.
But I don't think either Google or Microsoft offer anything unlimited, especially not for $60 a year.
Yeah.
Well, not unlimited.
You can get a lot from Google and Microsoft with OneDrive, but not – yeah. I'm curious what the caveats are with this. They immediately want my username, and they immediately want me to sign up for 3 months to find out. I'm trying to get the caveats of the unlimited storage.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I looked into it a little bit. I helped a friend set it up, and the best I can tell is that the big caveat is – they limit the speed at which you can transfer data. So I think that's their mechanism for limiting how much data you can really store on there. But past that, I couldn't find any real limits. I kept thinking eventually there must, you know, maybe it's only limited to JPEGs or only limited to, you know, MPEGs or something, but no.
We got to ask the audience. Maybe somebody out there in the audience has tried it and could give us a report back, and we could do follow-up next week.
Well, like I use Google Drive, and I pay $3 a month for a terabyte of storage. Yeah. So it's absurdly cheap, even if it's not unlimited.
Yeah. The ones that really take you out back and empty your pockets out are Dropbox for the business stuff. It's unbelievable what we pay for that. It's unbelievable. Google, again, because they have so much other infrastructure in place to facilitate their other business needs, they have a ton of storage available as a side effect of that. And if you're doing some sort of clustered storage that's spread out across your network, and you could just – it's the pennies. It's going to cost you pennies. You already have the disk sitting there.
If you look at the cost, though – so you said you're paying $3 a month for a terabyte?
Yep.
So that's $36 a year, and I can buy a 1 terabyte drive for what, $50, $60?
I'd say it's just a little more than that, but yeah, I know. I mean, he's also getting the advantage of it being offsite, managed by a vendor.
There's definitely some infrastructure advantage. $38 plus $3.99 shipping on Amazon for a 1 terabyte drive. I guess what I'm saying is
how much? How much was it?
$38.
Wow, $38 holy crap.
$3.99 shipping.
Rekai and I were just looking at drives today, but the drives we were looking at were a little bit larger in size.
Well, and the other thing is too is I don't know. There's something to be said about would you trust your data to a $38 hard drive?
Well, I suppose though you're then also forfeiting things like the app or the ability to access it from other computers and things like that. The price is reasonable.
Yeah. I'm not sure it's unreasonable. I guess when you compare that to $60 for as much data as you want. Imagine this, Chris. Imagine if we took every raw episode, like all of the raw footage from LAS or whatever, and we started storing that on Amazon. And at any point in time, we could go back and say, you know, this was a really interesting episode. Let's go retrieve this clip. And we didn't have to worry about storing that on the on the local NAS. Mm-hmm. That'd be crazy.
Yeah, except that with the Amazon limited speed, it'd probably take 18 hours
exactly,
to upload.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, we do have a really cool idea for our local storage solution here at the JB Studio. We should talk about it.
Okay.
All right, let's talk about it. But first, patreon.com/today, user air episode 8 is here, everyone. And I want to say thank you to the people on the Patreon page who've either signed up because they love user air or grabbing the backgrounds. I get like little notes from people. They are really encouraging. Nice little, like, hey, thanks. Thank you for signing up and supporting us at patreon.com/today. Changes are coming. I posted a video did you see my video I posted for the patrons? No, I know you're busy, so.
I didn't see it, no.
Yeah, so I posted a video just for the patrons about some changes that are coming to our page. But it's all good. All for the better. And it'll all make sense soon. patreon.com/today is where we're going to raise funds for this show. At episode 10, things are going to change. And I'm not quite sure where we're going yet and how things are going to change, but I think things will start evolving here for the User Air show. And I guess we'll just say more about that later. What am I getting? Well, you're getting the background. That's nice, from the video. But you're doing something else. This show itself is it's a lot of work, it turns out. It's about 6 hours a week of work, plus however long it takes us to record, which sometimes can be surprisingly a long time. So it's a good time investment. So it is nice to get your support and helps keep us going. Patreon.com/today. And also, don't forget about the RSS feed, where the Diamond Collection gets released from time to time exclusively to the RSS feed. And it's really the best way to grab User Air when we release an episode, because we're not always going to make it out every single week. And so that's the best way to get it when we do release, is our RSS feed. And you can find those at error.show and just look at any of the show posts. And they'll be linked there. Patreon.com/today and error.show. Well, I think it was back in User Air 5 or somewhere along there, the idea to do a call-in show was born on right here on this very program. And it almost immediately resulted in an episode of Linux Unplugged that was sort of a one-off trial of this. And we were really happy with the results, and we've then later thought about it and really come to a couple of ideas that we really like. And Noah, being the maniac that he is, has gone really all in and has been re-engineering his back end to kind of be set up and good to go. And some of that includes hardware and new ways of doing things. So, Noah, give us an update on where things are at and what's new.
So I spent the first probably 4 or 5 days researching everything I could learn about how radio studios do call-in shows, because there are a couple of truths. It's always easier to follow the path of somebody else than it is to try and reinvent the wheel. Additionally, I also know that, as I learned from doing that one episode of Linux Unplugged, there are a ton of little gotchas that you would take for granted. Like, for example, I would have thought I could connect a computer to a mixer and take a voice call over a SIP client, and it would work just like as if that person was in Mumble. And that's not the case. That's not true at all. There is crossover, or crosstalk as they call it, which is basically a little bit of the audio that you send gets back into the audio that you receive. And so it either manifests itself in an echo or in a buzz or a line noise of sorts. Mm. And so I started with that. I said, okay, so I need a box to properly interface. I looked at that. I said, okay, well, that's great. So we got that. And then I started looking at, well, how do actual radio stations manage calls as they're coming in? How do they identify them as this person is on this line, this person is on that line? And I found the box that they use for that, so I got that. Then I needed the control surface so that I could take calls, put the calls back on hold. And also I wanted to be able to feed the audio back to the callers on hold so they can hear the program while they're waiting on hold. That was important to me, and so I got that problem solved. And then I started working on my own audio. What equipment do I need to get my microphone to sound the best? And so we talked about that a little bit. I ordered a vocal processor that is specifically designed for the brand and model microphone that I own. And basically, it takes the signal. The dynamic mics typically have a lower signal than a condenser mic. So it takes that lower signal, it amplifies it inside of this box, and then applies the de-esser, the expander, and the gate all inside of this box, does all of the EQ inside of this box, and then sends out a perfectly tuned audio signal as if it was a line level source from an MP3 player or a computer or something like that, that I can then feed into the mixer. And so basically, for every audio device that feeds into the mixer, you have one of these processors. And so I bought one that's specifically tuned for my microphone. Then I bought another vocal processor that is specifically designed for phone calls. So there are a multitude of different codecs that are used when you make a phone call. These days, it's not an analog phone anymore. It's digital. And so the G.11 codec is used if you're on just a regular cellular network. And if you're on 3G or higher, it uses a codec called G.722. And basically, you can set up this call-in system. Basically, I can specify what codec I ask from their phone, and I will get sent that particular codec, and then this particular vocal processor will take that codec and is tuned to cut out the parts of the call that aren't part of the human voice, and then add richness and fullness to the audio parts of the call that are coming in. So basically, if you got lost there, the long story short is, it takes what sounds like a phone call and starts to turn it into what sounds like a remote broadcast, even though the person, all the person has is just a normal 3G or higher phone.
Angela joined us on User Air for the first time to talk about something that she has been test driving, get it?
Yeah.
For how long now, Ange?
Since December 19th, 2015.
All right, so you have got some serious use. And I think I've been using it for a little bit longer than that.
Way longer.
And then I just recently upgraded to their pro version. I'm talking about automatic, and it's something for your car, not the automatic transmission kind of a thing, but it's something you plug into your car's ODB2 port.
Oh, I was just going to say diagnostic port.
Yeah,
that's apparently the correct way to say it.
I believe so. And anything basically built since 1996 has one of these. Mm-hmm. And it turns out your car knows a lot more about what's going on than it ever lets on, including how hard you're braking, how hard your acceleration is, all these kinds of things.
And so, all reported.
This is a little wireless adapter that you plug into your ODB2 port, and it communicates with your engine. It tells you things like your fuel economy. But one of my favorite features is it also notifies you when there's a check engine light, and in plain English tells you what the actual issue is. And now it even tells you how common it is among other...
Your make and model.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Which is a great, great feature. And on top of that, it allows you to clear engine errors, which if you've ever tried this, one of the really nice things is... I ended up with a really bad issue, and my truck started misperforming. Mm-hmm. And it would start shaking at intersections. So I'm just sitting there, I'm like, wow, this thing is really falling apart. Like, I'm really in some trouble. Using the automatic app, though, I cleared the engine lights, and it reset the way the truck was behaving because the truck's computer went into a degraded performance mode. And the automatic app told me this was the case.
That is really crazy.
And I used the app to clear the check engine light, and I got about another 10 miles. And then what it was is I had an exhaust leak. So I know from my experience in driving that an exhaust leak is bad, but it's not going to take me off the road. Mm-hmm. But when the exhaust leak gets a little bit worse, sometimes the engine has a hard time reading the right temperature, and that triggers a whole other series of events.
Yes.
And then the engine goes into degraded performance mode. By clearing those errors, I was able to drive fine and get it to the mechanic, and they looked at it, and okay, yeah, they've checked it out. Mm-hmm. And it's really also can be a major safety feature because when the engine detects a crash, the automatic app can be programmed to contact an emergency person like, you know, a family member or whoever it would be, mm-hmm. and send out messages, which if you're a parent... That is a really nice feature to consider, like in your new driver's car.
Yep.
And it also tracks your location you've driven and shows you a map with a summary. And there's some really cool features where you can actually dig into that data and generate really nice maps of the places you've been. In fact, I'll try to embed one in the show notes. Mm-hmm. So you say you take a road trip. I went to Grand Forks, North Dakota. And now I have a light on a map of everywhere we drove in that entire trip or my trip down to Scale. It's all represented on a map.
Yep. There's three main things that the app on your phone is going to report to you. It is your hard brakes, your
hard accelerations,
and driving over 70 miles per hour. Because apparently, you know, in the United States,
there's
no speed limit over 70 miles per hour.
Well, and it's also trying to give you tips to get better fuel economy. And mm-hmm. at 70 miles per hour, you're sucking down the gas.
And it grades you by the week. Like, so every Monday, mine resets. The week starts. I'm 100% right now. That's my score. And I'm actually an A student on average. Like, I stay between 92 and 98.
And so. You kind of want another data source than what the dashboard is telling you.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the other nice thing about automatic is you can start to compare your different drive styles and techniques to your fuel economy directly. I can see per trip how my fuel economy breaks down.
Exactly. And that's what I found is the route that I was taking to drop the kids off at daycare, the girls, I was hard braking constantly, you know, and having lead foot. So anyway, in my since December 19th, 2015, I have had, according to the web,
they have a dashboard.
On my browser.
They call it the labs. And in there, you can really pull out some great details and data.
Yes. I've driven 10,000 miles. I've spent 400 hours. That's the other thing is time in the car.
This is another thing is you can analyze the time spent in the vehicle and if that was spent driving to work or luxury. And the other thing you can trigger is events. It ties in very nice with if this, then that, and it can trigger different things on the back end for you automatically depending on your time. And if you use any productivity apps that track what you do on your computer, and, you know, how long you spent on Facebook, how long you spent in your IDE, how long you're in this application. They also can tie in with some of those applications to include your drive time and how you spend your time and analyze it.
And in addition to that, they have a, you can tag as business.
Now, this is where our two experiences begin to diverge. So so far, everything we've talked about in the automatic is something like the automatic light or the traditional automatic that connects to your cell phone over Bluetooth LE. And then your cell phone's data connection is used to do the batch processing and send it up to the cloud. And an iOS or Android app reviews the data or their website. I recently switched to something called the Automatic Pro. And I thought this, well, I like pro things. This is obviously the way to go. The Automatic Pro, I thought, would be great for when I go on road trips specifically for JB. I could tag those sessions using this as JB expenses. But when I'm driving it for myself, I'd make sure it's tagged properly for myself. That seems like that's a pro feature.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even add that feature at first. They just recently did it in October. But what got my eye on the Automatic Pro is instead of using Bluetooth to connect to your phone, it comes with 5 years of unlimited 3G service.
Ah, interesting.
So it's always connected.
Mm-hmm.
So you can always check the location of your vehicle, and you don't need your cell phone nearby for it to get tracked.
See, that's what's cool, though, because I had my car in the shop last week for 3 days, and just as soon as I got back in my car, it synced all the data that happened while I wasn't there. So it's not like
that.
It doesn't track.
Right.
It just needs your connection again if you get the Bluetooth version.
However, what's kind of neat about this, and again, I kind of go back to if maybe you have a new driver or somebody like that, but when Hidea was borrowing my truck 2 days ago, I could see every time she started and stopped the truck because mm-hmm. I would get a push notification on my phone that my truck has started driving.
Uh-huh.
And that's just kind of nice to watch that, could have sort of that overview, because I also now have one on the RV. So I can check in on the location of the RV all the time, which is very mm-hmm. nice because that's where all my stuff is.
Yeah, right? Chris likes the creepy big brother feeling. No,
well, I do like to be able to monitor these things.
For sure.
And Automatic is their own company, so it feels like it's probably a safe-ish place if you're going to have something hosted like this.
Mm-hmm.
But the Pro is a completely different breed. It's its own app. It doesn't have the driving score.
Oh, really?
Doesn't do that.
Interesting.
It doesn't do like some of the driving analysis that one does. It does mm-hmm. some, but it, mm-hmm. not as much.
I just want to add, this is not a paid ad, by the way.
Oh, yeah. No.
But this is just us talking about a tool that we use in our daily lives that we enjoy and we want to share with you.
Yeah, the beard calls it hacking our cars because essentially you get access to functionality. It's already built into your car, but they've never given you a UI to utilize it.
Yeah.
Including some of the newer adapters will send real-time engine performance data to your phone or tablet. So you can have like all these gauges up on your phone or tablet indicating all your different engine information. And that actually, for me, is super nice because ironically, in the RV, we have this huge F-35 Super Duty engine. It's just this monster of an engine. And I have a speedometer and a tachometer.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a couple temperature gauges, but I don't have half the information I even get from the dashboard on my truck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've got a way larger engine I'm working with, and sometimes I'm climbing mountains. And I don't know what the hell's really going on because none of it's represented, and none of the gauges they're all so inaccurate. I can't really tell what they're reading. So to be able to get real-time temperature data so I know if I'm in the right gear and all that kind of stuff when I'm climbing up a pass is super valuable because the engine has it. In fact, the engine even knows what my fuel economy is at this moment, but they don't show it to me.
Mm-hmm.
I can pull all of that. So I really like those features of it. Even if you get the automatic light, you get a lot of this kind of stuff in it. I think the light is pretty cheap. Yeah, it's $80 for the automatic light. And then the Pro, which includes the 5 years of 3G, is $130.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, I think I got mine on discount for like $50 or $60.
They sponsor various podcasts. So every now and then you can hear a promo code out there.
Yeah, so I bought mine December 19th. Yeah. And then my car
insurance. I think
we both
got like 20% off.
Yeah, and then my car insurance was ending January 31st. So when I was renewing it, they said, oh, you know, of course, they're checking for all the discounts that I could possibly have. And they're like, well, we have this one where we send you something to put in your diagnostic port. And it will tell us like how you're driving.
That's the creepy stuff.
Right? Yeah. So I was like, well, okay, I just ordered one, like I paid for it myself. And they do this free of charge, you know, the Progressive or whatever car insurance companies that do this program. I said, I'd really like to see how I drive first. You know, like, I don't want to release that data to you yet until I know how horrible of a driver I am. Anyway, so I just decided to stick with the automatic. I don't know if the Progressive discount is worth it. I don't want to have a bad driving day and get in an accident that day and they pull that data and be like, well, you had 6 hard brakes right before you crashed. So something was obviously wrong with you. Like, I don't even.
Yeah. And so I actually was able to get a GPS tracker discount on my insurance now that I have this. So I got a small discount on my insurance. I don't know. They didn't ask me for details, and I don't know if they, but the automatic has continuous 3G. So that to me was like, I consider that a tracker. So I did check that box for the tracker discount.
And Progressive did say that they don't actually use, like, let's say I'm a
I don't believe it either. I don't even want to encourage my car insurance company remotely collecting car data from me.
I agree. They claim, though, just in case anybody looks into this, they claim that they don't use it against you. They only use it to decrease your premiums.
For now.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you can either get one yourself and monitor yourself and not worry.
It's surprisingly interesting. And now that I have I took off the old automatic, the first generation automatic, which doesn't do the real time engine data. And I'm putting the Pro in its place. But now I'm going to keep that old automatic. And if Hadia's car has a problem, I'll plug it into the port, connect it up to my phone, diagnose it using the.
You can have multiple cars.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, yeah, yeah. It's really easy to switch between multiple cars. So now I have this floater that I'll use to help people out and stuff. And I think that's going to be really handy too.
A couple other things to consider. When I brought your old truck to our mechanic, a trusted mechanic that we've had for years, he actually had to verbally request, may I remove this from your diagnostic port? There's something about that they have to request to remove it. It's clear that Acura, when they had my vehicle last week, they didn't have to remove it, which I'm not sure how they did the diagnostic to figure out my AC relay was broken without that, but whatever.
Maybe there's another port. And the other thing, too, you know, a lot of emissions places use that port. So you from time to time are disconnecting that thing.
Right.
It's interesting because that port's always powered, so the automatic always has a little bit of juice, but I don't think it drains the battery much.
Gosh, I hope not. I already had to have my car Bluetooth disconnected.
It might
for
go
doing
to
that.
Sleep or something, but when you first set it up, you plug it in and it goes boop beep. Like it gets a little bit of power.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and the automatic Pro also doesn't beep when it's connected.
Was that a setting? Because there is a setting to turn it off for mine.
No, because it's not connecting over Bluetooth. It's always on the 3G.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So what you get instead is a push notification once you've started driving.
Okay.
Or stopped.
Yeah. I do enjoy the fact that the automatic app does work on my phone as well as my Apple Watch. So.
Oh, really?
When I am running low on gas and I, you know, sometimes I just don't look at the gas, you know, like I just don't look.
Yeah,
I have three kids.
Yeah,
they're driving me nuts. I don't look, but my watch push notification, you're low on gas. Oh, okay, good. You know, that is helpful.
Do you get other information on the watch?
No, so far, I think that's the only, well, I did get, I don't know if I got it on my watch or not, but I had a tighten your fuel cap error the day that I put my car in the shop.
Mm-hmm. I will say this, there's a couple other little minor differences between the Pro. The automatic Pro is not quite as awesome at tracking fuel fill-ups, which is kind of a bummer. They've added it, but for a Pro, that kind of seems like a major feature that could be better.
What do you mean by fuel fill-ups?
Well, so some versions of the non-Pro automatic adapters will automatically detect when you've filled up your car because the engine says your gas is full.
Oh,
and automatically log,
The
Pro doesn't. You have to manually add it. Now, it'll GPS where you're at and say, okay, well, this is the price of fuel that you just paid, and you can manually enter it.
When you say add, what do you add? Do you just say,
I go a little plus button and say add fuel up session.
Weird.
Yeah.
That's really weird. That seems like a step backwards.
So I would say if for your case and you want the driving score to help you get better fuel economy and you want to combine the trips and stuff like that, the standard automatic adapters might be better. For those that want the remote connectivity, the always-on connectivity, and the push notifications when you're driving, like say you got a new driver or a shared vehicle, something like that, the automatic Pro is slightly more appealing, and you don't have to hassle with Bluetooth pairing any of that kind of stuff. There's still a setup process, because you have to associate that adapter with you.
Mm-hmm.
But so far, we've both been using automatic now for a while, and seem pretty happy with it. And they didn't, like Angela said, this wasn't a paid thing. It's just something we wanted to share with you and something that the Beard mentioned. You're hacking your car. You should probably talk about that on the show a little bit. It is nice to go from a car that's sitting at the intersection just shaking itself and it's like really freaking you out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not accelerating right. It waits a little longer to shift. These are all modes that the engine gets in. And when I know it's just an exhaust leak and the car doesn't need to be freaking out like this, to be able to clear that and then drive for a couple of days with basically the truck was brand new again, Just absolutely nice when you're really busy. Plus, getting that plain English diagnostic information and knowing how many drivers have that same problem gives me more peace of mind.
Yeah, because the cars, they come up with that code, and then you have to pull out Google, and you have to Google it, but it just shows it right there. Yeah. You don't even have to.
And you know, when you Google it, you always get cancer back as an answer.
Right, yeah.
Arriving soon at the studio should be the QNAP review unit with lots of storage space in it. If things go as I'm told, 24 terabytes of storage space. And we're going to be doing a lot of different testing of this rig. And Rikai had a great idea to help us out on our main FreeNAS system that's here in the studio, which is totally filled. I mean, it's got like how much free space right now, Rikai?
I think 200 gigs.
Yeah. So we're getting we're getting really close.
That's today. Yesterday it had 6 gigs.
Yeah, I was gonna say, what did you have to delete to get 200 gigs? Because it didn't have the 200 gigs last time I was
precious human culture. Let's just put it that way. Rikai suggested, one of the ways we test out this QNAP is when it arrives and we get it set up, take everything off of the FreeNAS and move it to the QNAP, and then use that opportunity to upgrade the drives in the FreeNAS.
That is a good idea. That's a great idea.
Yeah, I'm watching the price of Bitcoin, and if it keeps going up, I might just get the courage to order a few drives, because I think that would be a really great opportunity to increase our storage here while we have... Because what else are we going to be able to move 12 terabytes of data and store it somewhere extra? We're always running tight on storage on all of our rigs.
Yep.
So that's kind of our plan, Noah, is a rebuild and do you think a reload of FreeNAS too?
I don't think it needs it.
I would, and then you can get to the latest version and yeah.
Well, and we could always update. I don't know if we need to reload.
On the other hand, the
virtualization system?
Reinstalling the FreeNAS operating system is not an easy process from the other time I had to do it.
I've been pretty successful, but you just have to
Hold on. I feel like I must be misunderstanding. Did you just say reinstalling the FreeNAS operating system is not an easy procedure?
Yes.
It's literally as simple as plugging a flash drive in and clicking one button, and FreeNAS is installed.
You should try installing it on a system that does not have a USB access.
So I'm just looking on Amazon here. So an 8 terabyte Red is $319.
Going to stop you right there, Noah? You have to look on Newegg, because only Newegg accepts Bitcoin.
Okay. Well, I assume the price is somewhat comparable,
you would assume
though, right?
So, but that's not always the case.
I see. So I guess my question is, how many drive slots are in there? Let's just assume that
4.
The motherboard support. Okay. So conceivably, you could get 32 terabytes if the motherboard supported it.
Minus parity drives and
oh yeah. How does the FreeNAS Mini work with the operating system? Can you put it? Is it like on a compact flash card?
Ours is, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's on its own little drive. And then all of the disks in the FreeNAS tower are dedicated to the ZFS array.
Yeah, okay. So I just looked it up. So the WD Reds on Newegg are 360. So they are a little bit more expensive. 360, 258. So conceivably, as long as the motherboard supports it, you could get so what are you saying, Rikai? 20 I'm bad with math. So 20 some odd terabytes.
It depends on how you set it up.
What are you guys thinking?
I think probably sets of mirrors, but I'm not sure. I'd probably consult the Oracle first and find out what he says.
I want the FreeNAS Mini XL.
Yeah.
I'm not very familiar with the FreeNAS Mini lineup. What is the FreeNAS Mini XL?
A bunch more drive bays, essentially.
It's a taller one. Yeah, it gives you more drive.
At some point, would it not make sense to look for a rack mount unit?
I don't know how you do all the things you do. Really, I really don't. You and I do not live in the same space-time continuum. I do not get the same amount of things done in the same amount of hours that you get them done in.
Wait. I thought your complaint was going to be the expense, but your complaint is the time?
Theoretically, if I could afford a rack mount hard drive unit, I would be happy to do. The cost would not be the big issue. It's the problem is, I've got a project list that is ridiculous right now. Like, so Angela's house. The arch box in there finally had to restart because of the windstorm recently. Mm-hmm. And it's got like libcurses 6 while everything on the system depends on libcurses 5. And so you can't log in, you can't get a shell, and you can't get Plex to start. So their TV system is down. So she wants me to replace that. Meanwhile, I've got problems up at the RV that need to be solved there. Then I got this QNAP drive thingy that's supposed to have arrived last week that I'm sure is going to arrive probably tomorrow. I mean, there's so much going on. Well, I don't know how I'm going to get any of this stuff done.
See, the difference here, Chris, is with the studio, you have a built-in Rakai that can do things for you. I wanted to go back to the Amazon topic for a minute.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
So, Chris, did you know that Amazon is secretly launching a YouTube competitor?
Through Twitch or what?
Yep. So, I think it was like a week or two ago, they very quietly launched a video on demand service where you can just upload videos to Twitch now. And they haven't really talked about it at all.
So you can upload pre-edited together videos and then publish them on your Twitch channel or what?
Well, I don't know what the integration is with the live stuff, but you can go to, because Twitch has, when you go to a channel, it has a button to see like past broadcasts and stuff, but you can also upload files now and they can view those files even if you never aired them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Boy, wouldn't that be a thing?
I don't see that taking off.
Why?
Because I see anyone else trying to penetrate the YouTube market like I see Canonical trying to penetrate the smartphone market. That is such a solid base as is, and there is so little resistance to being on YouTube to begin with that there's little motivation to go somewhere else.
I think you incredibly underestimate how much YouTube creators are fed up with YouTube.
No, I mean, so Chris and I watched Eric Jacob's Nomadic Fanatic, and I mean that's pretty much a weekly thing for him, how frustrated he is with copyright concerns and how he has no way to address them. But at the same time, like, you have to think, it's a two-part mechanism, because on one part it's this is the way we know how to do it, and tools are built and systems are built and support systems are in place for uploading here, but the other big component to that is, where are eyeballs at? And that's going to take a lot to get
Noah,
people off
have
of.
You realized how popular Twitch is?
I suppose for gaming too. Like, if you were like,
in
if
a
you
niche
were,
market, yeah,
yeah. If you were going after gamers and you could start publishing and being live, and you already had a following there, because there's people that have quite a following on Twitch.
I like that Noah thinks that Twitch is a niche market where outpacing users of live television now,
okay,
where you can get 36 million concurrent viewers.
Rakai, follow me on this. YouTube, you name a genre, people that are making music, people that are making games, people that are making vlogs, people that are making RV videos, people that are making tech videos, and you name it, that's on YouTube. How many different categories
are on
Twitch? How many are on Twitch? How many of those are on Twitch? Name me an RV channel on Twitch.
I think everyone except for the RV channel is on Twitch.
I think it's going to depend on, like, I could see makeup and vlogging and... how-to videos and all that stuff on YouTube, but I could see more technical stuff or...
All those things you've mentioned are on Twitch now because they added a creative category, and they have categories for food channels now.
Are you saying it's like a gold rush over there and creators are moving over there because there's an audience and it's not as dominated right now?
Partly, yeah.
Huh.
Twitch is growing a lot.
Amazon is sly like a fox.
Yeah.
They got something going here.
That's why I said secretly launching a YouTube competitor.
Well, I tell you what, the day that Twitch overtakes YouTube, when I see more YouTube or Twitch links showing up on my Facebook feed than Twitch, then I will say, yep.
Twitch is already pulling in more viewers than ESPN.
Yeah, but that doesn't surprise me, though. I mean, first of all, have you ever watched ESPN? Like, let's stop for a second and talk about this. I had a friend that he had ESPN in his house. I don't pay for cable, but I'd go over to his house and like 9 in the morning, he'd be watching a program. And I started to notice like at 2 p.m.,
yes,
the same program was on. And then yep. 7, and he would still be watching it. And I'm like, didn't I just see that 4 hours ago? He goes, yeah. It's like a 4 or 5 hour loop that just goes on and on and on. And for some reason, people sit in front of their couch and watch this loop over and over and over again. Like, and even if I cared about sports, which I don't, even if I did, I couldn't sit and watch the same thing, same 4 hours or 5 hours of programming 3 times a day. That would drive me nuts. Anyway, all that to say, the fact that Twitch, which has independent new content coming out, has more viewers than ESPN is not at all surprising to me.
I find it all to be exciting.
Yeah, I agree. Competition's always a good thing.
I would love someone to just, even if they're nipping at YouTube's heels a little bit, making YouTube even just a little uncomfortable in their seats, that would please me greatly.
That's why I think that, specifically, that Twitch has a good chance where other services like Vimeo and all those didn't, is because Twitch has already built an audience, and now they're putting that audience on a new thing that they're putting in, whereas the other services tried to build up from scratch, and since it didn't compare to YouTube from the beginning, well, who's going to use it?
Well, you're talking, I mean, if you're talking they're doing live streams at the user sizes of tens of millions, then who else could even compete with that? That's YouTube and Twitch that are pretty much at that level, and that's it. The bandwidth requirements and infrastructure requirements of tens of millions of concurrent video sessions is astronomical.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they have the hardware backing of Amazon now.
Yeah, they were never going to survive unless they got bought by Amazon with those numbers.
Or Google.
Yeah.
That was originally mm-hmm. the rumors that mm-hmm. Google was trying to buy them, and right. I think they were, so but that, Amazon outbid them.
So that really wouldn't solve the problem, though, right? Because the problem with YouTube is Google.
No, the problem is YouTube is lack of competition.
So I guess, could you elaborate on that a little bit?
I feel that monopolies are bad, essentially.
Sure.
Anything that doesn't have competition is going to stagnate, and they have no reason to make their service better. If they have competition, they'll have reason to make their service better. I think that will make both platforms better.
So you think there's a problem with YouTube servers?
Well, there is definitely people that have issues with YouTube, but I think their infrastructure is pretty nailed down in terms of delivering the content.
Yeah, I didn't
say servers. It's their customer service that's the problem.
I said services, not servers.
Oh, I see. The big thing I've noticed from people that complain about it is that no matter how big you are, no matter how much money you bring in, there's no service infrastructure for people to call up and say, hey, you know what? I have a copyright complaint and I need some help. It doesn't matter if you have 100,000 views.
I would say the big problem with YouTube is there is very much a – they take care of certain YouTubers with certain numbers. They have representatives. YouTube will even supply them with additional editing staff or facilities to record in mm-hmm. if they need them. And then further down the tier, you get to like the level we're at where there's a rep and I can kind of pull on them from time to time. But I also get surveys that don't seem to be from my rep, and sometimes I got other reps that are all of a sudden my rep, and there's not like a real clear communication between YouTube and Jupiter Broadcasting. It happens sporadically throughout the year from time to time. And we go through the same ostensibly awful system that just about everybody does for copyright violations. But there are certain YouTubers, and you can't really blame YouTube as a company because some of these YouTubers are bringing in numbers that just simply are important to YouTube's bottom line. That YouTube very much takes care of them and works very closely with them. And so there is a bit of a class system at YouTube, but understandably, you're going to pay more attention to the people that make you more money.
Yeah, I think that with Twitch, there is still a class system, but even though there's a class system, it is still very easy to contact Twitch support and get help as a small guy.
Yeah, are they still active in some chat rooms and stuff? I know there used to be like their Twitch chat support room that you could go into, but that was a long time ago.
I don't know. I do know that their admins just randomly go through smaller channels to see how things are going. So sometimes you'll be streaming and then there'll be a Twitch admin that shows up in your chat and just starts chatting with you, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. No, I'm ready for off the wall.
No, I'm good.
You ready? Okay. Please direct all of your hate to alan@jupiterbroadcasting.com. But so far this year in 2016, I haven't gone to the doctor. And I don't know if it's because I've been forced into buying healthcare that I don't want and have to pay prices I don't want. So like the stubborn streak in me is like, well, I'm going to prove them wrong by never needing to go to the doctor.
Yeah. Hey, I'm right there with you. I haven't been to the doctor since I was like 6 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's been a few years for me too, but... This last couple of weeks, I thought, oh, I better go in because there's one thing that freaks me out. And if that's something that impacts my ability to podcast and if my hearing starts to go or my voice starts to go, that'd pretty much get me in the clinic. And I ended up from the previous road trip that I went on where I did a lot of swimming. So this is a while ago. I got an ear infection and I thought I'd beaten it because, you know,
I'm an adult male. I don't get ear infections. I'm not a 5-year-old child. My children get ear infections, so I'll beat this. And so I didn't really pay much attention to it. And then about a month ago, about once a day, I get kind of a sharp ear pain. And then a couple of weeks in, it accelerated to a couple times a day. And then about every 2 hours or so, I get like this really intense, painful pain in my ear. Okay, I definitely have an ear infection. And so I'm going to get into the doctor, I decided. But just things just kept coming. Rika, how would you describe the last month or two of work here at JB?
Nonstop. I think that's the best way to describe it. Every week we've either had to do double recordings or record an extra show where we didn't think we had to or something. We had extra recordings for like Unfiltered where we had debates on a different day. So we had 2 show recordings where we normally have 1.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're working on trying to bring the production quality up on everything. And so it has just been, there has not been time for me to get into the doctor. And so the ear infection spread to a sinus infection, which then spread to a double ear infection with a sinus infection. And then it was starting to go to my lungs. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe that just because I'm not getting my ass into the doctor, I'm getting myself seriously sick. And I still have a little bit of a cough from it. And so I really started to beat up on myself because I knew I had this urgent medical problem that was just going to get worse and would start to affect my ability to do the shows. At the same time, I had responsibilities I had to take care of, and I just wasn't going in. And so I got to a point where I'm like, well, I'm going to try to figure this out because I've got a 45-minute window here while we're traveling north. I busted out my laptop, connected, did the you know tethering thing, and started just doing research and discovering the difference between a bacterial infection and a viral infection for your ears and for your sinuses, and I realized, okay, I kind of identified the things I would need to do and what the doctor would likely do if I had gone in. You know, they would maybe perhaps prescribe antibiotics depending on if it was a viral or bacterial infection. And so then I realized, well, I might be able to take care of this. And I'm not ever going to say anybody should do this. I should have gone to the doctor. Don't do what Chris does. But I'm just telling you what I did to get through a very serious infection that I was dealing with that, I mean, I don't often get super, super sick where I'm like down for half the day in bed, but that's where I was going with this. I was down for the count. But I ended up rinsing my sinuses with a very gentle mix of water and apple cider vinegar.
The Natty Bowl or whatever it's called?
It's essentially using that with this combination. And you'll have to go research and Google the mix. Or I might try to find a link for the show notes. It's apple cider vinegar is an antiviral, antibacterial, and garlic oil in my ears.
Hmm.
And we
garlic oil is a natural antibiotic. Yeah.
And antifungal. And so we got these drops that are specifically like very super concentrated, little dipper dropper thing. And we've done it before on the kids, and it's just worked great. So I've had years of success with the garlic oil. And I just don't like doing it because it stinks. But man, I'll tell you what, two days of rinsing once a day with the apple cider vinegar water mixture and 2 days of doing the drops, and I immediately turned it around. I still have like some residual effects, but I went from being in, I would say a scale of 1 to 10 of being like a 7 to 8. And within 2 days, I was back down to a 5 or a 4. And now I'm like at a 2. And, I mean, I'm still totally willing to go to the doctor if things flare back up. I mean, I'm not going to that point of pride is one I will put to the side. But right now, I really feel like I feel stupid, but I feel like I hacked my body. Like I just attacked the problem intellectually. Like I looked at what can I do? What are things the doctor would likely do? What could I do with myself with what I have in the short amount of time that I have? And it all just kind of came together and I was able to do it and I feel a lot better. So I just felt like all of a sudden I felt like this hocus pocus hippie with a homeopathic recipe to solve my sinus infection. But I'm here to tell you, it worked wonders.
Good job.
Thanks.
Here's the thing. I'm all for natural remedies. In fact, my dad, who's a board certified cardiologist and been practicing medicine for 30 years, highly advocates natural remedies over traditional medical practice. And mind you, there are pharmaceutical companies that pay him thousands and thousands of dollars to go attend all of these meetings where he is privy to the absolute breaking of the latest science in cardiovascular health. And he would tell you that the first thing you should do is you should try a couple of things like eating kale and eating green leafy vegetables, and that even when you take your pet into the to the vet, the first thing they ask you is, what is your pet eating? Why doesn't your doctor ask you what you're eating? Because diet is so, you know, so closely concentrated. Yeah. And there's plenty of things, plenty of natural remedies that will produce the same effects as medicines do, except they don't have any of the horrendous side effects that medication does.
I've had experience where I went in once before for something and was prescribed antibiotics, and it screwed my digestive system up so super bad that I just really want to avoid that ever again, because I think antibiotics are a bit of an A-bomb sometimes on your system.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like a spectrum where you should try a natural remedy first, and then if that doesn't work, then go to a doctor.
Yeah, you got to be willing to throw the towel in and say, okay, I need some serious medical advice here.
Yeah, the part where I take issue is people that just refuse to go to a doctor ever, no matter what's going on.
That would be
because
me.
Or that time I stepped on that nail.
You're going to get tetanus and die, Chris.
I was seriously upset about that.
I know.
I was, because I've had that experience before myself, Chris. I've had a nail through my foot.
Oh, yeah, it was no fun.
Yeah, but you didn't die of tetanus, so it's all good.
And again, you know, that was a similar situation where I probably would have gone to the doctor, but we were so busy that I just limped around for a couple of days.
If I remember right, that was like a day leading up to or 2 days leading up to Linux Fest Northwest.
Yeah, it was.
The chances of you getting to the doctor those 2 days were about zero.
No, the chances were very high. He could have easily done it.
No.
He just,
okay, listen. Stop right there. If you want to make the argument that he should have taken time to go to the doctor, fine. Easily? No way, man.
I disagree completely.
No way. No
way.
We were
handling most of the work, Noah.
We could barely get... Rikai, I can't believe I'm having this conversation with you.
Noah,
we're to the point where we could barely get the stuff done we needed to get there. We're trying to get on the road. We're trying to leave for Linux Fest Northwest. And I dumped a couple of our producers off because we didn't have enough manpower to move them to the studio and go to the music store to get the cables that we thought we were going to need. And we're like throwing them in the back of the truck before we leave. We didn't even bother to check to see that we had the right one. Turns out we didn't. We were missing an HDMI cable. Like, that's how to the moment we're going. When was he supposed to go to the doctor?
Here's my counterpoint, Noah. Hospitals, you see, often are open 24/7, and there were periods of time where Chris went upstairs and just took a nap for a couple hours. He could have gone to the doctor then.
I honestly.
But that was like days before I stepped on the nail.
Number one, number two, I don't remember at all in the 72 hours leading up to Linux Fest Northwest, or really the 12 hours afterwards. I don't remember anyone getting much sleep.
You know, the other thing about that time, can't remember for sure, but I may not have had medical insurance then, because when you get a divorce. There's a period of time where you re-sign up for insurance and all that kind of stuff. And so I can't remember. There was another sticky issue about that. That's such an awful time. I hate the situation here in the States so bad. I'm not trying to proclaim we should be like anybody else. I just wish it wasn't this bad.
I'm specifically proclaiming that we should be like the other first world countries where people don't have to worry about their screwed up health. Because they don't have enough money.
So who should pay for it?
Oh, God.
that's the natural follow-up question. People shouldn't have to worry about their health.
Well, Noah, this will be a topic for another episode.